Ladies and gentlemen, this was a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This Sunday, like every Sunday during these holiday months, finds the Shrine of the Little Flower crowded to capacity. Today was Cleveland and Akron Day at Royal Oak. With the other unannounced visitors, some 20,000 pilgrims, in all, have made this a memorable day. Father Coughlin officiated at two of the solemn masses, participated in the benediction services, and he has already preached three sermons and is about to begin his broadcast. Next Sunday, August 13th, is Toledo Day at Royal Oak. The citizens of Northern Ohio have chosen this Sunday as their dedication day at the Shrine of the Little Flower. From the cities of Toledo, Troy, Columbus, and other places will come a vast number of loyal and faithful friends of Father Coughlin. They will assist at solemn services which begin promptly at 10:30 in the morning, and then return for a special service in the afternoon at 2:30 o'clock. Father Coughlin will officiate at both of these services. From the various cities of the nation have come reports that Sunday, September 2nd, will be a national day at the Shrine of the Little Flower. Over the Labor Day weekend, thousands of pilgrims will visit the shrine. However, Sunday, September 2nd, will find the Shrine of the Little Flower host to innumerable faithful and loyal supporters of social justice. Plans have already been made in cities reaching from New York to St. Louis, from Minneapolis to New Orleans, in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Chicago, to send large groups of patriotic Americans and loyal supporters of Father Coughlin to the Shrine of the Little Flower on that day. Father Coughlin has arranged a beautiful liturgical program for all the visitors. Plan now to spend your Labor Day holiday here at Royal Oak. Despite his evident fatigue, Father Coughlin is now seated before the microphone, ready to deliver the most important address of the day. An address filled with facts and figures. An address that will set forth the farm story in America in such bold relief that little room for further contradiction will remain. Ladies and gentlemen, you will not be able to remember this litany of facts and figures, and yet you will not be informed or prepared to discuss this question unless you have these facts at your fingertips. Therefore, please, for the sake of your friends and families, write to Father Coughlin this week and get this most important information to reread for them and to discuss with them. The address which Father Coughlin has prepared contains the most imposing assembly of governmental facts and figures in relation to farm problems. A problem that must be solved before the working men in the cities will share in the prosperity that should be ours. By the way, are you aware of the fact that last week the American Federation of Labor committed itself definitely to a living annual wage policy for the automobile workers? Naturally, those who have followed Father Coughlin and who have supported his theories of social justice applaud the American Federation of Labor for this progressive move. Social Justice Magazine will detail this story in next week's issue. And now I present to you Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, those of you who possess a copy of the Congressional Record dated July 28, 1939, are indeed very fortunate. It not only contains most valuable statistics, but also presents a picture of the sad plight to which our nation has been reduced. I am not a pessimist, nor am I given to foolish optimism. But I dare repeat what I have contended for many years, namely that the debt situation in America is altogether out of hand. Any fair-minded person even those who are in the creditor class, will admit that we can operate no longer on the financial system which has characterized the period during which our farmers and laborers were reduced from self-sustaining, independent, prosperous persons to their present miserable status. No longer can we afford to temporize with the unbearable burden of debt. If we attempt to do so, not one of us will escape the repercussions which are inevitable. For the financial system on which we have operated not only has decayed, it is now an actual menace with its crumbling walls to all our free institutions. The congressional record to which I refer contains information and tables of government figures which indirectly and directly bear out this assertion. The daily papers, of course, refrain from reproducing these statistics, possibly because the publishers were of the opinion that such reading would be considered too dry and too uninteresting. Nevertheless, risking the presentation of an interesting broadcast, I am of the opinion that it is advisable to present to you some of the facts contributed during this past session of Congress. And from these facts, if you and I have courage to meet them as a nation, it will be evident that a drastic change in our method of finance must be accepted, that a drastic change in our attitude towards the farmers of America must be devised. Otherwise, these unfortunate farmers, without whom America cannot subsist, and upon whom industry, commerce, and the entire nation depend, they will be liquidated just as surely as Joseph Stalin liquidated the kulaks of Russia. Time will not allow me to reproduce all the remarks and all the speeches delivered on the floor of the Senate referring to this question. However, at the risk of boring you, permit me to read from the speech delivered upon the floor by the Honorable Henrik Schibsted of Minnesota. The history of farm mortgages, said he, has to a large extent been the history of bailing out the commercial banks. The record will show that during the World War, the farmers of the United States borrowed on their notes and collateral something like $3.5 billion. When the crash of 1920 came, the banks had to have their money. And as a result, the farmers were induced to borrow money on mortgages on their farms in order to pay the banks, so that the banks could obtain their money. However, the farmers still carried the loans which they had been encouraged to incur during the war to increase production. The War Finance Corporation was created to make loans, therefore, to farmers in order that the farmers could pay the banks. But still, the War Finance Corporation. Later, the Farm Mortgage Corporation was created to unload chattel mortgages upon a federal instrumentality in order that the commercial banks of the country might be able to obtain their money, which the farmer previously had borrowed. And so we find the history of this legislation, which is said to have been for the benefit of the farmer. We find that it shows that it has been for the purpose of bailing out the commercial banks. So far as improving the condition of agriculture and of farmers is concerned, I point out the fact that in the past 10 years, 30% of the farmers, or one out of every three, have been sold out under foreclosure. The idea is quite generally held that we are making good progress in solving our economic problems, particularly those of the farmer. It would be ridiculous to contend that some improvement had not been apparent in the past year or two as compared with 1931 and 32. Oh, but what we're likely to forget is that such a comparison only contrasts faltering hope with black despair. There are those who would have us believe that the farm problem is rapidly moving to a solution. Here again we are dealing with a situation in which we are asked to compare a little of something with a great deal of nothing. Despite the fact that the federal government increased its payment in agricultural subsidies and benefit payments by 34% in 1938 over 1937, the American farmer had 11% less income in 1938 than he had in 1937. Much has been made of the fact that the farm mortgage indebtedness has been reduced by $2.4 billion. But how was it reduced, I ask? It has been reduced by foreclosing on farm mortgages, driving farmers out of their homes. When a farm mortgage is foreclosed and the farmer is taken away from the land, oh yes, the debt is wiped out. But that is how farm mortgage indebtedness has been reduced under this regime. In its 1948 report, the Farm Credit Administration discloses, quotations, the total farm mortgage debt dropped approximately $2.4 billion in the 10 years ending January 1st, 1938. And it dropped due to foreclosure, to less borrowing by farmers, and to refinancing after scale down of indebtedness had been made. As a matter of fact, continues this official government report, the scaling down of the indebtedness has been about $210 million, which is about only 2% of the entire farm debt of the country. And Mr. Norman J. Wall, the senior agricultural economist for the United States Department of Agriculture, in a publication prepared for the department last September, entitled A Graphic Summary of Agricultural Credit, Mr. Wall accounts for the sharp reduction in the farm debt, largely in terms of mortgage foreclosures. Says Mr. Wall, quotation, from January 1st, 1930 to January 1st, 1935, the mortgage indebtedness of farmers decreased sharply from $9,214,278,000 to $7,645,091,000. This reduction of 17% during this period resulted largely, said he, from foreclosures and other acquirements of mortgage properties by mortgagees. In another report, Mr. Wall also says the following. Namely, the chief factor accounting for the decrease in total farm mortgage indebtedness has been the liquidation of debt through foreclosures or assignment of title to the mortgage holder. My friends, the 17% reduction in the debt which we hear so much about was accomplished by assignment of properties without foreclosure and the foreclosure by the Federal Land Bank and other lenders foreclosing upon farm mortgages. Let us look at some ancient history, starting with 1910, when the total farm mortgage debt was $3.3 billion. At that time, it amounted to less than 10% of the $36 billion at which all farm lands and buildings in the United States were valued. The peak of the farm mortgage debt load was reached in 1928, when it was $9,468,000,000, or 20% of the value of all the farm lands and buildings in our country. In 1933, when land property values were at their depression low, the debt represented about 28% of the value of land and buildings. So, despite the sharp cut of $2,400,000,000 in the farm mortgage debt following 1928, which brought it down to about $7 billion level at the end of 38, this smaller debt still represented 20% of the value of all farmlands and buildings. The total farm mortgage debt today is about what it was in 1920. In 1937, it was $7,254,000,000, and in 1920, it was $7,800,000,000. But in 1920, land and buildings were valued at $68 billion, and the mortgage debt represented only 12%. There's a great deal of difference between conditions in 1920 and 1937. By 1937, the value of all farmlands and buildings was cut almost in half. And they were then valued at $35 billion. Oh, but the mortgage debt, instead of being 12% of the value of the land buildings, was now, in 37, 22%. So, in terms of underlying values, the smaller debt of 37 is twice as hard to carry as the one in 1920. In terms of the farmer's income, the difficulties which confront him when 1920 is compared to 1938 or 37 are shown to be even more serious today. In 1920, the farmer's gross income was $13,500,000,000. In 1938, it was $8,882,000,000. And of this sum, mind you, $482 million were government benefit payments to the farmers. The exchange value of the farmers' produce, moreover, is not as favorable today as it was in 1920. I desire to call attention to another situation. We have subsidized by government appropriations the payment of farm mortgages and federal land bank notes to about $130 million in the last 4 years. And still during these 4 years, 65,000 farms in the United States have been sold out by the federal land banks on foreclosure. So far as the farm mortgage and farm situation is concerned, we are approaching a period when we will be sitting on the top of a volcano that will explode with devastating effects. But to return to the subject of the reduction of the farm debt, there are some who point out to it as an accomplishment. Well, let's see. Since 1934, some 110 farms out of every 1,000 farms have been sold at forced sale. In other words, one farmer in every 10 has been dispossessed. In the 7 year period before that, taking us back to 1926, some 200 in every 1,000 farmers were dispossessed by forced sale. So over a period of a decade, almost one-third of each 1,000 farms in the nation has changed hands through forced sale. It is in this manner that the farm mortgage debt of the country has been cut down. There's the truth of it. Another result of these foreclosures is that the five principal lending agencies of the country held land valued at $1 billion at the end of 1938. This represents about 125,000 farms, or 28 million acres of farmland. It's about equal to the entire farming area, for example, of the state of Minnesota. Now, what has been the effect of this policy? Since 1920, the percentage of farms operated by tenants, non-owners, has risen from 37 to 42%. And the farmers now constitute only 25% of the total population instead of the 30% represented in 1920. These figures can only suggest the human tragedy that lies behind the farmers of America. Lost homes and savings, poverty and pauperization, relief and nomadism. These have been the only answer that we have apparently been able to give to the most serious economic problem we have ever faced as a people. More rapidly than almost any other country in the world, we are actually creating a landless class. 64% of the present total farm mortgage debt is on farms that are owner-operated. Obviously, if we are to save owner-operation of farms, we will have to meet the mortgage problem on the farm face-to-face. Let us examine in a little more detail the changes that have taken place in the distribution of the farm debt by lenders, and more particularly, the activities of the two federal farm loan agencies, the Federal Land Bank and the Land Bank Commission. In 1930, 12 9/10% of the total farm mortgages were held by federal lending agents. Today, about 40% of the total farm mortgage debt is so held. Most of this increase, mind you, has come since 1933. And with the table which I will print for all those who request a copy of this discourse, you will see from official figures that this predicament has grown worse in the past several years. In 11 states, these two federal agencies now hold more than 50% of the farm mortgage debt, and in 40 states, they hold 20% or more. At the end of 1938, the Federal Land Banks and the Land Bank Commissioner had $2,735,074,803 in loans outstanding. Who owns United States? That figure almost suggests that question. Since May the 1st, 1933, the two federal farm lending agencies have made loans totaling more than $2,500,000,000. What was this money used for? Almost all of it, my friend. 87.8% of it, in fact, went to refund outstanding debts. Taking the period from May 1st, 1933 to January 1st, 1937, the latest for which percentage figures are available, we learn that 70.8% of the proceeds of federal land bank and commissioner loans were used
to refinance previously existing farm mortgage indebtedness. In other words, the farmers were loan money not to help the farmers, but to help the original lenders, the banks. An additional 17% was used to refinance indebtedness, other than mortgage obligations, that farmers owed to commercial banks, private individuals, and to taxing agents. Only 4.9% of that tremendous amount of money went for the purchase of land and for the actual redemption from foreclosure. And not more than 3.3% was used for buildings and improvements on the farm, and these are governmental figures. It cannot be said that the farmer was borrowing money for any expansion. As a matter of fact, the farmer was borrowing money with which to pay his previous creditors to relieve the banks and the lending agencies that had loaned money to the farmers on a constantly decreasing farm income. The banks knew that the farmer's income now was not able to sustain the loans. Therefore, the banks had the government lend farmers money so the farmers could pay the banks. I wonder if the farmers will ever be able to repay the government with their decreasing income. Well, once more the farmer was refinancing and recomposing his debt, converting short-term into long-term loans. That is a process with which every farmer has become familiar. During the period of the war, and immediately after the farmer heavily increased his short-term borrowing at his local bank, he was told that he must feed the world. And so he did. He was told it was his patriotic duty to produce more food for Europe as well as for America. And so he did. But the farmer didn't have the cash, so he borrowed it from the bank. By 1918, he owed the local bankers $2,500,000,000 on his opener collateral note. This was $400 million more than he had owed the bankers in 1914. By 1920, these short-term loans reached the peak of $3,869,000,000 that the farmers owed the bank. By 1931, this figure had been cut in half. And in 1934, the farmers' notes at local banks totaled $807,613,000. All this short-term debt was in addition to the farmers' mortgage debt. In addition, I say. Well, what reduced the short-term loans of the farmers during this period? How were they reduced? Not by payment out of production, because there was no more production for Europe. They were reduced by borrowing on their farms, in other words, by increasing their farm mortgages. When the banks began to call for a payment of farm loans in 1920, you know that the Depression began way back then. Farm purchasing power was drastically curtailed by the forced collection. Farmers who had any credit were encouraged to slap a new mortgage on their farm and take up some more short-term paper. Those who could not supply the cash, well, they were foreclosed. Country banks with frozen assets began to close in the farm areas and loans were canceled. Well, for the most part, the evil day was postponed by refinancing, as we call it. Let's see what happened. From 1920 to 1931, the short-term farm credit held by commercial banks decreased by $1,932,531,000. From 1920 to 1930, the farm mortgage debt rose by $1,335,000,000. $383,690,000. During the period from 1920 to 1927, when most of this earlier rewriting of debt was being done, the farm mortgage holdings of insurance companies and federal and joint stock land banks increased at the rate of $377 million annually for all three of them combined. And from 1920 to 1928, these three federal agencies increased the amount of their loans by $2,622 million. This increase was $1 billion greater than the actual increase in the total farm mortgage debt. Commercial banks and private lenders were moving out of the agricultural lending business. The short-term debt incurred by the farmer to win the war was being written into a long-term debt by new government agencies and old ones that were expanding because of funds dumped into their hands through war profits that could not find an outlet. Who owns the farms? Are you beginning to see? Well, obviously, this change for the farmer from one lender to another after the war, and again in the 30s, did not solve his debt problem. The debt problem remained the same. The only thing the farmer traded was a new borrower. He did not have a chance to liquidate his debt. He only had a chance to have a new kind of lending agent.